May proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I please report? And thank you for allowing me to appear before this court. I represent People's Bank, the plaintiff in the trial court, and the appellant on appeal. The sole issue in this case is one of personal jurisdiction over the Frazees. The bank argues that Frazees' purposeful directed activities toward the foreign state, Oklahoma.
I had a question when I was reading your brief. And I'll ask you because you're an Oklahoma lawyer. We're required to give full faith and credit to the judgments of Oklahoma. And it's the same full faith and credit that the Oklahoma courts would give. So if you were seeking to enforce this judgment in Oklahoma, upon which party would the Oklahoma courts place the burden of showing whether or not there was a court that rendered the original judgment had jurisdiction?
Well, I think that the analysis in Oklahoma would be the same as the analysis should be here in Missouri, which is, given the fact that judgment was rendered in Missouri, the presumption being in Oklahoma the requirement that the court determine whether or not it has jurisdiction before entering a judgment, regardless of whether that judgment is entered by default or in a contested matter, that the burden then would fall upon the party seeking to undo the court's determination to prove that jurisdiction did not lie. So, in our case,
because the real question in this case is whether or not H.L. Frazee purposely availed himself of the benefits and protection of the laws of Oklahoma in signing the guarantee for the
guarantee, but in his son specifically telling the bank, look, I know I'm in trouble here financially, but my grandfather will, in fact, stand good for me in contact with the bank, in repeatedly contacting or having conversations with the bank, in which he first initially says, all of this in our affidavit is unrefuted by them. Okay. Let me discuss this with my son. I'll get back to you. Then further contact with the bank. His obligations to provide continuing financial information, all of that purposely directed. And we're not talking about here what they have in Burger King, what they've identified in Burger King, which is some unilateral activity by a third party that just simply touches upon a non-resident. We're talking about here the specific activities. This is a specific jurisdiction case, not a general jurisdiction case. We're talking about the specific activities of Mr. Frazee directed towards Oklahoma.
Are you aware of the Bryant case that we recently handed down?
I think I just read it. I'm not sure. I mean, in terms of principle, I read the case, and I think
it was a tort issue in that case.
But in terms of the court's analysis, I certainly think that it's supportive of where we are on this case. My concern in this case is that it's been argued that we are turning the constitutional debate on its head by suggesting that you take into account the effects of the activity purposefully directed towards the forum state. And I would suggest to you that just the opposite of truth is the actual test required under Burger King and further in Calder versus Jones. I'd like to take credit for it. Unfortunately, I didn't come up with it, which is the effects test set down by the United States Supreme Court, in which they specifically say that jurisdiction over the non-resident depends on the extent to which the defendant's contacts with the state proximately result from the actions by the defendant himself. To suggest that this is a new argument, that is, that you take into account what effect that activity directed towards the forum state could have in the forum state, flies in the face of a direct quote out of Burger King, which specifically says prior negotiations and contemplated future consequences are to be evaluated in determining minimum contact.
Isn't almost every contract going to have some sort of effect in the state, though? I mean, if that's all it is just signing a contract is not sufficient normally. I understand the guarantee may be different, but if the contract is for some activity in the state, then under your argument, wouldn't just signing the contract be sufficient?
I think you have the quality of the contacts and the absolute effect. But I think you have to, that's a better analysis that is taken into effect or into account what the effects are in the forum state than the analysis suggested upon this court that's been rejected by a majority of the courts by defendant's counsel in this case, which is you have to have this requirement of some financial benefit on the part of the non-resident.
Well, the overarching question is whether or not the exercise of jurisdiction by Oklahoma over Pidge Hill Frazee was fair. So that's really what all of that's directed to. So
absolutely correct. And I think what Burger King says is that the contract alone isn't all by itself enough. So you look at the totality of the circumstances, that is the activities directed toward the state. And again, this is a specific jurisdiction case. So we're talking about these activities which were directed towards Oklahoma did in fact cause the harm complained of in the initial complaint. So, I mean, our statute, the Oklahoma statute, is similar to the Missouri statute in that it's intended, the long-arm statute is intended to stretch the jurisdiction of the Oklahoma courts to the limit allowed by the United States Constitution of due process.
And at what point did the guarantee take place? Was it after the Younger Frazee was in default?
The Younger Frazee was in default of his loan. The loan was about to be called. He was meeting with the bank at that time. And at that particular point in time, he suggested to the bank, my grandfather will stay good, and that's when the contact began. So it was an interjection on the part of an Oklahoma resident, that being the Younger Frazee. And then the Missouri resident interjects himself into this Oklahoma transaction.
Does it make a difference who initiated the contact? I thought it was the father, but you said for the grandfather in Missouri. Or does that make any difference whether or not the grandfather called Oklahoma or the banker called the grandfather to ask him to be the guarantor?
I don't think it does in this case because of the continuing contact after that. So it may have made some difference if, in fact, and none of this is known because they chose not to contest any of these facts in the trial court, which is, you know, it's been suggested that the burden of proof is much ado about nothing, but in fact, it's very important. But the unrefuted facts are that the initial call and my witness was unsure about whether or not the call had been made by him first or whether Mr. Frazee had in fact contacted him. We know the initiation of that came from the Frazee family.
Is there any dispute that the bank would have called the loan if he hadn't gone on to the loan as a guarantor?
There's no dispute of that.
No.
When would a guarantor?
What happened afterwards was that Mr. Frazee then says to the banker, regardless of who made the call, okay, I need to discuss this further with my grandson. And then there is no doubt about the second call, or maybe even possibly a third call, initiated by Mr. Frazee, in which the discussion of the guarantee and the terms was had between he and the
Was there any evidence that there was any financial benefit to the guarantor?
No evidence that there's direct financial benefit to the guarantor, and I think that's the essential argument. And the Court of Appeals, they're raising this standard, which has been adopted by a minority of the courts. It's been rejected by a majority of the courts, but it's been adopted. And in the Missouri Court of Appeals, they suggested that was determined. There's no such law in Missouri. Never has been any such law in Missouri. And I would suggest that the analysis by a majority of the courts, if you look, courts in Alabama, Arizona, California, Texas, Florida, Kentucky, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and the District of Columbia, have addressed that very issue and have found jurisdiction. It is a minority of the courts that have said, unless there is some direct financial benefit. But I can't understand the reason for that. The fact of the matter is purposefully directed activity towards the state, causing an effect in the state, is the same. And if the benefit is simply for the benefit of a family member, what difference does it make? In fact, if you look at that very issue, was addressed in Alabama in the Millett case, but almost directly on par with this case is the Perry case out of Kentucky, in which a Virginia resident signed a guarantee, mailed it out to Kentucky for the benefit of his daughter and son-in-law.
Well, I mean, part of the problem is there's so many of these grandparents. I mean, say, I want to stand, the grandchild says, will you stand by me? They think they're signing a reference. They don't know they're financially liable, and that's part of the quote-unquote equities of the issue is that there's so many of them that do that, and they don't understand that when they sign a guarantee, it means something.
Well, and I'm not arguing with the court on that, but there's no suggestion, nor was there any factual presentation that suggested that there's a defense here that I didn't understand what I was signing. I mean, there was conversation, there was more than one conversation back and forth. And as the Kentucky case clearly says, look, your family derives benefit, you get some benefit from it, you're directing your activities towards the forum state. It's not offending traditional notions of fair play, because you should know if something goes wrong, that Oklahoma bank is going to want you to answer in Oklahoma.
Is, under your argument, is there any situation in which a guarantee is not sufficient to create jurisdiction? Or are you just saying guarantees should always be sufficient?
I'm not saying that at all. And I think that there may be some factual scenario in which, because as they say in Burger King, we can't have this mechanical test. And I think you've got to look at the totality of the circumstances. And in this case, you've got not only the shifting of the burden of proof, which was in error, which I think is significant in terms of the decision, but you have sufficient context and you have sufficient effects in the form state. It's not just a, hey, somebody told me you might sign this guarantee, I'm mailing it to you, if you would, sign it and send it back. I mean, there were actual discussions back and forth. And I think clearly, I mean, what we're talking about here, there's no doubt about the minimum context. I think it's the second prong of that test, which is, does it offend traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice? The Missouri Court of Appeals clearly said, look, it does unless there's some financial benefit directly attributable to the non-resident. And I would suggest to your honors that if you adopt that standard, I lose, okay? My client's gonna have to come up here and readdress this. But it's a standard that's not been adopted by the majority of the courts and certainly is not consistent with current Missouri law. Thank you.
Chief Justice, may I please the court? I know it's all Mr. King, so I'll move that down a little bit. Judge Steele, I'm going to go to your question. I think this also relates to a question that Judge Wolf asked, because if there is a situation in which a guarantee, where there, if he says there are factual scenarios where a guarantee would not be, of itself, would not be sufficient, if this is one of those cases, I don't know what it is. Because the only thing we have here is the sending of the guarantee. Now, we talk about who called whom, and I think your Bryant case says that doesn't really matter. Mr. King says that doesn't really matter. The issue, it seems to me, is what ripple effect did this cause? Because in my mind, I'd put it in the context of my 8-year-old throwing a rock into the lake, which he loves to do. Now, in this case, my client threw a rock into the lake, and it sank. And it didn't cause any ripples. What all of the cases that the bank cites and relies on talk about are this ripple effect, the additional effect of a commercial transaction. And I'll take you to the Burger King case because I think this directly answers the question, and Mr. King, I think, left something very important out. Because it says that the minimum requirements inherent in the concept of fair play and substantial justice may defeat the reasonableness of jurisdiction even if the defendant has purposely engaged in forum activities. And the reason it says that is sort of a two-step analysis. First, did you purposefully direct yourself to activities in the forum state? And the Bryant case that you all decided a week ago talks about activities and directing, purposefully directing, availing yourself of the benefits of doing business in the state. Okay, that's the first prong. But then Burger King has the second prong. And it says that a contract with an out-of-state party alone is not sufficient to establish minimum contacts. And it goes on to say, and if I can read this to you, because it's, I can't say it as well as Justice Brennan said, it is these factors, prior negotiations, and contemplated future consequences, along, and this is the important part that was left out, along with the terms of the contract, and the party's actual course of dealing that must be evaluated in determining whether the defendant purposefully established minimum contact.
But didn't the contract indicate that if you sign this guarantee, and you're guaranteeing, and I guess the next question is, and I'm trying to hit you two questions at once, but is if we decide according to your position, then why would in legitimate situations where the grandchild wants a guarantee and the grandparent says, I'll do that so you can get this car or whatever, they won't do it. Why would a bank take a guarantee if it's no good anymore?
Well, it's not that the guarantee is not good. Now, that leaves aside issues of defenses that might be raised. It's not that the guarantee isn't good, Judge Teitelman. It's where are we going to have to be subjected to suit on the guarantee? We have taken the time in the state.
And I assume the guarantee was, the contract itself was silent. It did not acknowledge jurisdiction of the Oklahoma Court.
The contract had no venue selection clause, and no
forum selection.
No forum selection clause, excuse me, and no conflicts of law provision.
It but
didn't
it did
say who's
say
law governed. I'm sorry.
But it did say if the principal contractor doesn't pay, I have to pay.
It said that, yeah, it did. But it doesn't say where a suit's going to be brought, and that's the issue, I think.
Well, is part of the issue that you knew it was an Oklahoma bank, an Oklahoma debtor who lived in Oklahoma, an Oklahoma contract and business. I mean, everything was in Oklahoma except the guarantor.
Well,
we don't have a situation where there's multiple states. So
that's true. There were only two states involved.
Right.
Now, let me take you back to Burger King, which is what I started to say, because it goes to what you raised also, Judge Tidelman. The terms of the contract itself can't be enough. And Burger King specifically enumerates three things there and says that the contract is the step that ties together the prior negotiations with the ultimate ripple effect that I'm talking about when you throw the rock in the pond. Now, if this had been a situation, for example, where the loan guarantee went to the son and daughter-in-law so that they could hire a building contractor who would then hire subcontractors and order materials and do all of these things to engage in commerce, it might be one thing. If it were, as in the Perry case from Kentucky, where the loan guaranteed not only the existing debt, but also guaranteed the advancement of additional funds that were put into a restaurant business and creates the ripple effect of economic commerce, that's a different case. But in this case, all the rock did was go in the water.
And what did it guarantee?
I'm sorry?
What did it guarantee here? What was the guarantee? It guaranteed what?
The guarantee was for the renewal of the loan, which I cited a case in.
Loan for what?
It was a personal loan secured by a couple of automobiles.
Okay.
As far as the record.
It wasn't
goes.
A business loan. It was
but
a personal
not a business loan.
Loan.
No, not as far as I can tell. There's nothing in the record that says that it's anything
right.
other than a personal loan. And it was secured by two automobiles. There was a substitution of collateral as part of it, and they got two other cars. There's absolutely no evidence that my client got anything out of it other than the satisfaction of helping his relatives, which the United Buying Group case out of North Carolina that I cited to you and also the Bond Leather case say, that's good, but that's not something that's enforceable in the courts of Oklahoma.
Is that a minority position?
I don't think so, Judge. I think all the cases that he's talking about are cases in which there was a commercial effect or where the guarantor was dealing with something that happened to be a commercial venture in the forum state. And the North Carolina case is the quintessential case where the president brother, the president of the debtor corporation, the president brother, signed a personal guarantee in Virginia for the North Carolina debt. His brother, doctor brother in New York signed a guarantee, but the doctor brother had no financial interest in the corporation. The North Carolina Supreme Court said that the brother who had the financial interest in the corporation, whose actions in guaranteeing this loan actuated commercial action in North Carolina, was liable to jurisdiction in North Carolina. But the brother who lived in New York, who had no financial interest in it, and who was simply helping out his brother, was not subject to jurisdiction.
Well, the difference between the commercial transaction and these consumer transactions that occur every day, and I assume there's no requirement of plain language or the flesh test, so that whoever signs a guarantee understands what they're signing.
Oh, I think that's true. But I don't, again, respectfully, I don't think that's quite the issue that we're here to talk about, because the question is, where do you get sued on it? It's not what does the guarantee say, and it really isn't what are the defenses to the guarantee. And I started to say a while ago, Mr. King mentioned that if we lose here, they're going to have to come back sue here. Now, I've been through this in the Court of Appeals. I'm here with it now. I still haven't heard why they can't just do that. We've taken the time of 11 judges in this state, from the trial court to the Court of Appeals and now all seven of you, to decide an issue that would be really simple if they just went back and accepted this decision and filed a new lawsuit. And that's what's going to happen if you affirm this judgment.
Well, is your position in your analysis, as your opponent describes it, to be the minority view in this country?
I don't think so, Judge, and I'll tell you why. I only found two cases that dealt specifically with the situation in which the guarantor had no financial stake in a transaction that was not a business-related transaction. And believe me, we've gone through this briefing process twice. If they're out there, I think I could find them. Well, and they haven't cited any to you. The closest thing they've cited is the Perry case from Kentucky, which involved a dad's guarantee of the daughter's loan, but that loan went in partially to buy a restaurant business, and the court said he had a commercial stake in it, had a stake in the success of the business.
So really the only issue is whether or not, if you're looking at it from your standpoint, whether the grandfather's interest in helping a relative was sufficient to be the kind of benefit that would be analogous to a commercial benefit.
But I
think that what's interesting is that both of you are channeling Justice Brennan. And there's something in that opinion for everybody. And truly there is, because he was in the minority most of the time on these cases, and he finally got the majority, but I think he had the wrong case. But he talks about the, this and that, and this isn't enough, and this isn't enough. But then after you've looked at the activity that's been generated by the, in this case, the guarantor, then you look at the overarching question of whether it's fair. That's really where he wanted to start, but he had to sort of end there.
Well, I guess, I think that in some respects that's a hindsight analysis. Because, yeah, that's the ultimate question, the overarching question constitutionally. But we know, and regardless whether Justice Brennan was in the minority most of the time and then the majority happened to get it in this case, we got a flat statement in Burger King that is controlling law on federal constitutional law under the 14th Amendment that says a contract of itself is not enough. And that contract serves to tie up this and this. It's the bridge. Now, if you accept Mr. King's analysis, the contract is not just the bridge, but it's also the final result.
Well, no, he said there's prior negotiations. There was the telephone contacts back and forth. There was the grandfather talking with the grandson, and that there's continuing obligations to provide information about financial resources to the bank during the terms of the loan. So why isn't that something before and after?
Because the ripple effect of this transaction, the end intent of this transaction, is not something beyond this.
So if the people had used it to buy a house, then there would be jurisdiction, but because they used it to pay personal debts, there's not?
No, I don't think so. Well,
what do you mean by the ripple effect then?
The economic benefit, I go back to the opinion you released last week in Bryant, where it talks about purposefully availing oneself of the privilege of doing business in a state. Okay. And if you go back to Hansen versus Dinkla, it talks about the benefits and the protections of its laws. Now, under this guarantee, I don't see anything in terms of benefits that my client could have sued on in this guarantee. The only thing, and they argue this in their brief, is the protection of defenses that might
well,
be raised.
Well, now wait a minute.
Okay.
If the bank had, after he signed this guarantee, if the bank had gone ahead and foreclosed on the property anyway, in violation of the contract, your client could have sued the bank in Oklahoma, or even in Missouri, and invoked the protection of the laws of Oklahoma as to that contract. So that is a benefit of the laws of Oklahoma, because that contract's governed by the law of Oklahoma, I assume.
Wouldn't my client have had standing to sue for a wrongful foreclosure when my client didn't own the property that was foreclosed? I don't quite understand your question.
Guarantee should give him something, shouldn't it?
He's got to be somewhere. Otherwise, why wouldn't he just walk away from it? There has to be some mutuality of obligation.
I'm not so sure, and I don't know what Oklahoma law is on this, okay? I'm not so sure that under Missouri law that you have to have any consideration to support a guarantee. Matter of fact, I think the law is just the opposite, that a guarantee is not required to be supported by consideration, so I'm not sure there is a mutuality of obligation there under a guarantee. Now, I don't want to misspeak and say that I'm telling you what Oklahoma law is, because I don't know. But I think the law in Missouri is to the contrary.
So but would it be your position that there has to be a financial benefit to the guarantor, that the guarantor has to have a financial interest in the contract that it's guaranteeing in order for there to be jurisdiction?
Judge, in all candor, I don't know that I would say that it's a per se rule, because I haven't thought all those things through. What I do know in this case is that the ripple effect of what I'm talking about doesn't exist beyond the contract itself. And as I said in my brief, there is never a situation where any bank is ever going to admit that it didn't rely on a guarantee. There's never going to be a situation where a bank isn't going to go in and convince a local judge in that jurisdiction against an out-of-state resident that it didn't rely on a guarantee, or that the out-of-state residents ever got to convince the court that the bank didn't.
But then there's a situation where the banks could say, we're not going to take a guarantee because it means nothing, and then the whoever they're trying to guarantee won't get the loan.
They could have said that, and they didn't.
But that could happen in the future if we decided.
Do we have any evidence here as to why there was no defense, why no one went to Oklahoma and defended this suit?
No, there's nothing in the record about
and
that.
And the law does seem to be that since there is a valid judgment, that the burden was on you to show why that there was no jurisdiction, not the other way as it would have been you defended in Arizona, Oklahoma.
I think we sustained that, Judge, because when you read the judgment, the only thing that made any difference in was the trial court's finding, based on the bank's vice president's waffling in his affidavit, that either I called Mr. Frazier or he called me, that she was going to resolve that against the bank as to who made the first call. Now, we've just established that it really doesn't make any difference in this case whether the bank called him or he called the bank. And if you go further, in the filings that they filed, that the bank filed in the trial court, in the suggestions, it took the position that, in fact, the banker had called my client first. That was the bank's own interpretation of that affidavit. But the affidavit itself waffled. That's the only thing that you can read in that judgment that the trial court used to, in Mr. King's words, shift the burden of proof the other way. The judge looked at the totality of the circumstances and said, there's nothing here beyond the contract.
The distinction that you're making in these cases, whether or not there was any ripple effect or there's any other commercial transactions involved in deciding this case, has that distinction ever been identified by any other opinion in this country?
I would cite you to the North Carolina case, the United Buying Group case that I discussed in my brief, and also the Bond Leather case out of the First Circuit, which deals with a similar situation, except there the guarantee was by the brother's corporation, not by the brother himself. In both of those cases, it was a matter of helping out a family member, and in both of those cases, the court said there is no long-arm jurisdiction sufficient to get you into the forum state. And to my knowledge, Judge, those are the only two cases that are out there that deal with this narrow factual situation. I don't think that when you're right on this slate that you're going to write a case that has far-reaching consequences, because I don't think this comes up very much at all. Virtually every one of these situations is one where you have a guarantee by a shareholder of for a corporation that incurs a debt in the forum state, or you may have a guarantee by the spouse of a shareholder, but all of that ties through to the ultimate purpose for the loan, which is to permit the doing of business in the state. The ultimate purpose of this loan wasn't to go further, it was to renew this loan. And in fact,
finish that if you would.
In fact, under Oklahoma law, it's not even a new loan. And I cited a case for you there. The underlying loan remains the operative loan. The renewal extends the deadline, but it doesn't create a new obligation even.
In the First Circuit in the North Carolina case, did they have contact back and forth prior to the guarantees being signed?
I think so, Judge, but I don't want to tell you they did without going back to look at the case, honestly. I don't recall.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's inaccurate to say that there's not another case, because the Perry case out of Kentucky directly on all fours of this case. It is a relative. It is an argument made by the father that I did not have a financial benefit in signing this guarantee, and it is an argument specifically rejected by that court.
Would you respond to your opponent's argument about there needs to be, in that case there was a commercial effect for a business?
Again, and this is the first time that's been raised. We have gone from we didn't have context to there has to be some direct financial benefit to now that financial benefit must in fact be commercial in some measure. And it all depends on how you define the ripple. To answer Your Honor's question, was there other rights that he could have asserted, Mr. Frazee, the guarantor in Oklahoma? Certainly. Had the bank foreclosed, had he paid on the guarantee, he had the right to come to Oklahoma and sue for the collateral back that his grandson had put up in order to recoup some of his loss. He had every right to come to Oklahoma and sue for that. And this, you know, this court, what counsel is asking you to do is create a different standard for transactions involving guarantees than you created in Bryant.
Was there any requirement in Oklahoma that the guarantee be notified of the litigation against the principal signer?
There's no such legal requirement. It can be contractual. It can be part of the guarantee.
Bryant dealt with tortious consequences in the state, and if you committed a fraud, sent fraudulent documents in the state, you knew they would have continuing consequences in the state. So I'm not sure that's a strong support for your argument in light of Mr. Schnocke's argument that there were no continuing consequences.
Well, but of course I disagree with that characterization, right. But the court's own statement in Bryant says allegations of extraterritorial tortious act that yields consequences
right.
in this state. And that's, you know, what we have here is even beyond that. We have acts directed specifically to Oklahoma that yielded consequences in the state of Oklahoma.
Couldn't your client have really resolved this or at least made it a lot easier case for your client if they just put something in the contract saying going to be governed by Oklahoma law, venue of any suit will be in Oklahoma? And they chose not to do that. I mean, they wrote the guarantee.
Well, I certainly think it makes the guarantee stronger, but Your Honor is probably familiar with the fact that there are a number of cases now coming out that suggest even forum selection clauses aren't sufficient to get by the due process test if the underlying facts wouldn't support it. So, yeah, it may have made it stronger. Certainly there's some law from the United States Supreme Court that would suggest that you can waive this jurisdiction argument. But I don't think a failure
Or whether he would have thought he might be brought into Oklahoma to, you know, if,
sure.
if he had, that was written in the contract.
And in this case, Oklahoma is a neighboring state, a border state versus Citicorp, which is a corporation in South Dakota, which issues its loans from South Dakota.
And to your point, I do think that if you adopt the standard, which will be a new standard, I think that you certainly are going to have a chilling effect on neighboring states wanting to issue guarantees to individuals who are not residents of the state.
Why does the burden of proof issue make a difference here? Because I just see only that one fact question about who initiated the contact. And if we presume that the grandfather initiated the contact, is there anything else that burden affects?
All of the issues with regard to whether or not there was any direct economic impact to them, I mean, none of that was ever addressed in the affidavit. They just said, we don't live in Oklahoma, and we just signed this guarantee. It was their burden to come forward instead of just making this argument.
You're saying they didn't make a record that they had no financial interest, maybe they had made loans or they had an interest in the property
That's
in
correct.
Oklahoma. They made no record.
Or some agreement with the son-in-law or... You know, what the discussion was between the two of them, none of that was addressed. They just simply said, well, hey, we're not a Oklahoma resident. We don't own any property in Oklahoma, and therefore all we did was sign this guarantee, and there's no jurisdiction.
Any further questions?